hppodcast.com.
What has happened to Wells? I gasped. And then I saw the wet tracks leading into the kitchen. Howard saw them too. His eyes flashed with momentary relief. I'm glad he's safe, he muttered. I feared for him. Then his face darkened. The kitchen was unlighted, and no sound came from it. Without a word, Howard walked across the room and into the darkness beyond. I sank into a chair, flicked the moisture from my eyes, and brushed back my hair, which had fallen in soggy strands across my face. For a moment I sat, breathing heavily, and when the door creaked, I shivered. But I remembered Howard's assurance, "They haven't reached the farm yet. We're safe here." Somehow I had confidence in Howard. He realized that we were threatened by a new and unknown horror, and in some occult way he had grasped its limitations. I confess, though, that when I heard the screams that came from the kitchen, my faith in my friend was slightly shaken. There were low growls, such as I could not believe came from any human throat, and the voice of Howard raised in wild expostulation, "Let go, I say! Are you quite mad?"
That was an excerpt from Frank Belknap Long's The Space Eaters, and we are here to grasp this story's limitations here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you can find us at hppodcraft.com. Back with us again this week is our very own Andrew Lehman. He is a delight and a treasure.
That's right. I don't know if you've been to the revamped online store at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, but they've done a redesign. It's looking really slick. Man, talk about delights and treasures. It's full of them.
It's got great stuff.
I was thinking, you know, Lovecraft writes about all these fictional cults, and then years later you have the Historical Society make all these t-shirts and radio dramas and actual idols you can purchase based on those things. What if one of the HPLHS shipments was lost on an island in the Pacific and a cargo cult sprung up around that? It'd be like a self-fulfilling cult?
Yeah, I guess so. And then those people started worshiping Cthulhu and learning new ways to kill.
That's right.
Yeah.
Cult of the Innsmouth swim team.
I want to thank all of our supporters out there for backing us on Kickstarter.
Yes.
You guys were great. I can't believe it. We're going to have 3 readings, which is outstanding. And we're going to be getting in gear to produce those readings very soon. And we'll be getting in contact with all you folks about doing the roundtable discussions.
That's going to be
schedule
fun.
That stuff. For those people that participated at that level. And I just am excited about all the things that we're going to be doing in Providence and in Chicago.
Yeah, and some folks have asked, we're still locking down a venue in Chicago. We hope to make that announcement in August. And as always, suggestions welcome. But we're working on that right now that the Kickstarter has been completed, and we know we're definitely doing it.
Yeah, and I just want to put the little worm in your ear about
Ouch.
This, but not like creatures in our bodies.
Not like Star Trek.
No, not Star Trek 2. No, nice worms that will hopefully get into your brain and will make things happen, because I'm going to be doing a Kickstarter myself for my sequel to my first graphic novel, Transreality.
Nice.
And I'm hoping to launch it mid-August. Keep your eyes out for that.
It's Transreality Curly's Gold, right? That's the name of the...
The Legend of Curly's Gold. Yeah. That is the name of it.
I saw you casting around for funny sequel names on Facebook, and I really like Michael Welch's suggestion, 2 Trans, 2 Reality.
That was a good one.
That was a really good one.
Trans Reality 2, Trans Harder.
Trans Harder.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Let's pick it up from last week. What was going on in the story?
Right. Quick recap. Frank, our narrator, and his buddy Howard, and these are obvious parallels to Long and Lovecraft, are staying at a farmhouse. A fellow shows up, Henry, who's a friend of Frank's, and he says that he's had an incident where something dropped a brain on him and then crawled out of a tree.
Just your basic somebody dropped a brain on me story. We've all heard it before.
So he ran away. He felt this freezing pain in his head.
Which one of our commenters said he thought maybe that would have something to do with Lovecraft's affection for ice cream.
It could be.
These monsters give you ice cream headaches.
When he got home, he saw that he had a bullet-sized hole in his head, and then he felt okay for a while, but as they're talking, the pain returns to him. This Henry guy just runs off out into the woods.
Yeah.
Now, Frank and Howard go after him, found him in the woods, almost unconscious, and then they were pursued by something back to the farmhouse.
Something they can't really describe, they just know it's coming, and all the while there's this awful, otherworldly droning sound that follows them.
And then they arrive at the farmhouse, and our opening reading brings us up to where they are now.
Right.
After some sounds from the kitchen where Howard and Henry were, Howard emerges. He's covered in blood, and Howard explains that Henry had lost his mind and started acting like a dog, running around on all fours, and then he attacked and bit Howard.
Wow.
Howard clocked him, knocking him out. Again, not very Lovecraft here. This is definitely a fictionalized version of Lovecraft, as far as I know.
As far as I know, you know, we put up a photo with the story on social media last week that had Lovecraft and Long, you know, throwing a couple of shots at each other.
So maybe he was a scrapper, and that's just nothing he wrote about.
Maybe in the tradition of Hemingway, Lovecraft was hitting the boxing gym, going out and sparring with folks. And it's just a part of his life we don't know about. Hey, by the way, we kept saying Frank Belknap Long last couple of episodes. That's funner to say, but it probably is pronounced Belknap.
Yeah, somebody wrote in and said, you know, I love you guys' show, but you might be saying that wrong. You know, there's this ship that's, you know, it's pronounced Belknap. I looked it up, cited a few sources, and we're like, okay, yeah, he's probably right.
Yeah, I went back and there's a recording of him actually speaking at the World Fantasy Convention back in 1975. We've quoted it before. When he introduces himself, he says, I'm Frank B. Long, so he didn't give me the satisfaction.
So close.
I will say Belknap now, but it is fun to say Belknap. You got to give me that at least.
It is fun, absolutely. Yeah. So Frank begins to tend to Howard's wounds, but Howard, who's been a jerk through most of the story, continues his jerkitude and yells at Frank. He's like, look, that dude is knocked out for now, but when he gets up, he's going to be crazy. Go tie him up and then come back and fix my wounds. And Frank does as he's told. He ties Henry to a chair and then he helps out Howard. At some point, he says he telephones this guy, Dr. Smith, who shows up and checks out Howard.
Right.
He's like, I don't remember when I called him or what happened, but I know I did because I'm just in such a mental state because of all these crazy things that are happening. Yeah.
It was a nightmare, so hard to recollect the order in which things happened.
When the doctor shows up, he makes him feel better because he's got a very soothing personality. The wounds are superficial on Howard, so he looks at Henry and things are much worse for Henry. The doctor says his eyes aren't responding to light and that he thinks that Henry is near death. Mm. Frank asks him, does it the hole in the head, maybe? Maybe that has something to do with it. Is it a bullet, actually? He said it wasn't a bullet, but is it a bullet? And the doc is puzzled by this wound because it goes right to the brain, which should have killed him, but there also should have been clotted blood and it should have, you know, sealed up a bit, but there's nothing like that. And the doctor says that he has to also report this incident to the authorities because it looks like a guy's been shot in the head. The doc believes Howard and Frank are innocent and that maybe the wound is self-inflicted.
Yeah, and because it's self-inflicted, that's why they decide to not call the authorities.
Right.
It could be that we'll do whatever we're about to do and then he'll come out of it and he won't be crazy anymore. If nobody did this to him, he did it to himself, we don't need to get the police involved.
Well, the doctor says he needs to operate immediately if there's any hope of saving this guy's life. And he tells Frank to clean off the table and he's going to operate right there in the house.
But what is this operation exactly?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I was thinking about that myself. Like, if he just has a hole in his head, what are you going to, especially a hole in his head that's not bleeding.
Right.
What are you going to do in there?
I'm not sure if I trust this doctor. We have to do an operation to remove this hole. Quick, get me a bag to put the hole in. Something sturdy. It might be heavy.
Frank doesn't look. He's holding the light. And he doesn't look, but he hears the doctor working with his fingers. I'm like, what is he working on? It's a hole in his head. Like,
right.
Is he just sewing it up or something?
But before they operate, there's a little scene with Howard, who's been watching all of this.
Well, Howard laughs at this. The police coming. He goes, the police? Of what use would they be against the things in Mulligan Wood? Dr. Smith's response is, your friend has a slight fever, and apparently it has made him delirious. If you will bring me a glass of water, I will mix him a sedative.
Yeah, they're totally using the Mr. T technique to knock him out. I ain't going into Mulligan Wood. Here, drink this. Okay.
So, yeah, Howard drinks the water. He doesn't. They totally slip him a roofie and knocks him out. Thankfully, Bill Cosby wasn't there.
He put the pills in the drink and drilled a hole in the head.
God. So the doctor gets to operating. Frank's holding the light, like I said. Doc Smith is supposedly very good at what he does, but Frank can't look at it because it's gross to him.
Yeah.
The doc hesitates, but he hears him hesitate for a moment. He thinks the doctor made some kind of discovery.
Specifically, though, when Frank doesn't want to look at it, he says it is a dreadful thing to mutilate a man's brain. You know, you could have stopped at the word man. You don't need to be more specific than that. I think it's pretty dreadful to mutilate a man, period. Doesn't really matter what part of the body.
Well, you know.
But yeah, what is it that the doctor found in there?
He doesn't say. That's what's really cool about it and very weird. He continues working for a while.
Yeah, and Frank's getting all freaked
shaky.
Out.
Shaky. Yeah. And he asks the doc, he's like, how much longer do I have to hold this light? And the doctor's response is pretty nuts. He says, if you move that lamp again, I won't sew him up. I don't care if they hang me. I'm not a healer of devils.
Hmm.
Whoa, where did that come from?
what's going on in there?
Frank pleads with the doctor and just says, hey, look, man, you got to help this guy. You're the only one that could give him a fighting chance. And the doc continues working. He works for just another 10 more minutes. And then he tells Frank to put the lamp down. Mm-hmm. And when he does, Frank looks at the doctor and he's shocked because the doctor has visibly aged 10 years.
Whoa.
And then the doctor says, he'll be dead in an hour. I didn't touch his brain. I could do nothing. When I saw how things were, I sewed him up immediately.
And Frank asks what we're wondering. What did you see?
Is I saw, oh, the burning shame of it, evil that is without shape, that is formless. They will come here and claim him. They have laid their mark on him, and they will come for him. You must not stay here. This house is marked for destruction. And then he gets his hat and he freaking leaves.
Yeah. Yeah. What is going on?
How did the doctor get all this information from just looking inside this guy's head?
Well, I think kind of plays into... Not only, yeah, at first he sees it and it's terrible, but then he starts to understand the intent of what these things are or something. And I think it's,
yeah,
like, did going into the brain give him some awareness? Because now he seems to have the same, that same occult awareness that Howard has.
Yeah.
Because Howard keeps saying, well, here are the rules of these things and here's what they're doing. And how did he get that? It's like the minute you start to imagine them or come into contact with them, you don't know just them. You start to understand them as well.
Right.
But how this information transmits, I don't know.
And become vulnerable to them.
Right. I think that now the doctor is in the same position as Howard was, which is why he scrams so fast, because he's susceptible to this thing now too. It's like a virus or something.
As the doctor leaves, Howard comes to and he realizes he's been drugged and he's ticked off.
Yeah, it leads to his worst line in the whole piece. He says, you drug me and then ask me to walk? Frank, you're as unreasonable as an artist. It's got to be a little self-aggrandizing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's pretty good. Well, he says, Howard, we got to get out of here. You know, that's why he says, can you walk?
Right.
And Howard goes, yeah, we do need to get out of here. Mulligan Wood is safer.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, because that's where they saw the monsters.
But Howard knows it's all over for, you know, Henry on the Table, because he says he belongs to them now.
Again, he knows it. He just intuitively understands what's going on without actually, you know, reading a book or anything like that. There's just something about this creature that perceiving it gives you a deep understanding of it.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. This is a very weird, weird fiction. In this story, which is kind of this weird parody thing, but there's some rock solid weird fiction in this.
Yeah, agreed.
So he says that this fog, this place, is launching a point of something greater. Something's coming.
Yeah, this fog is some kind of invasion or something.
Yeah, well, he doesn't really say invasion, but it's implied that, that these creatures are going to come from and then just do bad things.
Right.
But Howard and Frank run off and they decide they're going to go to the shore, get in a boat, and then go out to sea.
Yes. Luckily, Frank has a launch that they can get into.
They decide to go out to open sea, despite the fact that it's so foggy and can't see anything. They know if they hit a storm that they're totally screwed because it's a small boat, but they hope to get close to the harbor and get picked up by a ship. But Howard's more skeptical. He says, how do we know how far they can reach? What are the distances of Earth to things that have traveled through space? They will overrun Earth. They will destroy us all utterly. And Frank's like, how do you know all this stuff? And he goes, I don't know. I just...
For Frank, it doesn't matter. He says, we can worry about all of that later. Right. We got to get as far away from them as possible. Maybe they've still got limitations and we'll be able to escape. This whole section was really strange. They hadn't set up a boat before, at least not that I saw.
No.
I was like, what? They're getting it.
They're by the sea. They did set that up.
They did.
But the boat is a new introduction.
It just felt a little like the publisher was like, look, I really like to finance this story, but you know... My nephew's got a speedboat. I think things might go a little smoother for you, a little fiction here, if you could work the speedboat in. You know, I'd like that.
Yeah, no, that'd be, yes, I could probably how it goes. Because nephews read weird tales, I guess, and they want to read more stories.
Did you ever hear off topic, but there was that FBI sting where they actually were making a movie with the mafia trying to.
Oh, right. Yeah, they made a movie about that, didn't they?
They made a movie about them trying to make the movie, yeah. But there was a whole speedboat angle. The guy, the mobster was like, my nephew's got a speedboat. It's got to be in the movie. I always love decisions that are made based on what the financiers think is cool. You know?
Well, that's Ed Wood, man.
Yeah, I want a big explosion at the end of it.
In the movie, in the Ed Wood movie, he goes, it's going to end with a big explosion, sky full of smoke. And Ed Wood goes, but it doesn't end like that. He goes, it does now.
Exactly.
So Frank takes over driving as there's a bunch of rocks out. Up ahead, and Frank knows the waters pretty well and how to maneuver around these rocks. But Howard gets really quiet as he looks back at the woods, and Frank realizes he's paralyzed with fear.
Yeah, because some of the fog has cleared and you can see Mulligan Wood now. What they see isn't pretty.
Well, first of all, Mulligan Wood is on fire.
Right.
But the fire isn't what's freaking him out. It's the shape that's above the fire in the trees.
The vast, formless shape that moved slowly to and fro across the sky.
And then he says, if we see it clearly, we are lost. Pray that it remains without form. So Howard turns away and tells him not to look back.
Don't look. It's the whole Raiders of the Lost Ark thing. Now, Frank, in this moment, a solution suddenly pops into his mind. And it's related to that opening quote from the Necronomicon and what we discussed last week.
To that about the cross, how the cross is this ancient symbol that was co-opted by Christianity. And then he says right here, it's older than our world. It's older than all religion. Before the dawn of civilized men, they knelt in adoration to it.
It's present in all mythologies, and it might have been used thousands and thousands of years ago to repel these very invaders. I shall fight the shape with a high and terrible mystery. So he's made a plan at this point, which is to show it the cross.
Yeah, I guess so. He tells Howard to light a match and get some cotton waste. I don't know what that is.
It was kind of hard to figure out. I just imagine they had all these cotton balls for some reason in the
boat. Why would they have all the cotton balls on a boat? I don't know. Maybe it's a boating thing that I don't understand. But
yeah, well, they do little drag shows when they get out to the, I don't know. They just have a lot of, I just imagine they had like a whole makeup.
Yeah, they had to clean up afterwards. Sure, yeah. They get all the makeup off. Howard says some weird stuff. He goes, yes, yes, light a match to warm our little brains. And he's like, no, no, we're going to make the sign over our body, which seems like to me they're just grasping at straws. But
Howard gets on board with it. He says, be bold. Show them that you are unafraid. Make the sign boldly.
And they do. They make it over their body. They do from head to torso and then across the shoulders. And then Howard does it again. And he does it out, like maybe he's doing it kind of towards the shape. Form
a pretty weird thing for the Lovecraft character to be doing, the atheist, you know, to be making the sign of the cross. And I think it's also that Fright Night kind of rule where you have to have faith in it if you want it to work. Maybe not Christian faith, but you have to have faith in the symbol itself for it to repel the invaders.
That has power. That it can be something to focus your will through.
Yes, exactly.
So Frank closes his eyes, but he still sees that shape, that formless shape above the woods. But as they're making the sign of the cross becomes less distinct and more chaotic, and he opens his eyes and it's gone.
The cross worked.
Then Frank gets dizzy, almost falls, but Howard catches him, and Howard says, we're saved, we did it. And then Frank passes out, and that gets us into chapter two.
Long time coming.
I know, the first chapter is really long compared to the other two chapters.
The first chapter is the actual story, and then these subsequent chapters are the kind of an epilogue or a...
Yeah, I'd say so. Chapter two starts off with Frank walking into a room where Howard is writing. He asks how the story is going, and Howard looks pale and rough. He says, story's not going well. There are elements of the story that I can't quite recall, and it just, I'm not getting them right.
Yeah, he's trying to write down everything that happened to them, which seems a little silly.
Remember, in the first part of the story, Howard was talking about trying to capture that uncapturable horror, and that was his life goal.
He was
doing everything to do it. So he's experienced now. He's trying to capture that experience. And we find out that it's been 3 weeks since the incident at Mulligan Wood, and Frank hasn't seen Howard at all in this time. We also find out that Henry's body wasn't found. Maybe it was burned up, or maybe it was taken by them. Mm-hmm. We also find out that there was another body found in Mulligan Wood after the fire, but it was all burnt up as a skeleton. However, it was missing the top of its skull.
That's the person who lost their brain to begin with, right?
Exactly. The brain that got thrown at Henry. So Frank wants to know what Howard knows, because he knows he understands more than he does. He wants to know why he's keeping it from him. But then Howard finally agrees to tell him.
You have asked me what the damn thing was that fell on Wells's head. I believe that it was a human brain. The essence of a human brain drawn out through a hole or holes in a human head. I believe the brain was drawn out by imperceptible degrees and reconstructed again by the horror. I believe that for some purpose of its own, it used human brains, perhaps to learn from them, or perhaps it merely played with them. The blackened, riddled body in Mulligan Wood, that was the body of the first victim, some poor fool who got lost between the tall trees. I rather suspect the trees helped. I think the horror endowed them with a strange life. Anyhow, the poor chap lost his brain. The horror took it and played with it, and then accidentally dropped it. It dropped it on Wells's head. Wells said that the long, thin, and very white arm he saw was looking for something that it had dropped. Of course, Wells didn't really see the arm objectively, but the horror that is without form or color had already entered his brain and clothed itself in human thought. As for the droning that we heard and the shape we thought we saw above the burning forest, that was the horror seeking to make itself felt, seeking to break down barriers, seeking to enter our brains and clothe itself with our thoughts. It almost got us. If we had seen the white arm, We should have been lost.
That's some cool stuff, man.
I was talking to Kip Barnes, who reads for us sometimes, the other day, and he listened to the first episode, and he said, you know, this story reminded him of, and certainly this has some Atomic Age-sounding dialogue in it. The movie that it reminded him of was Fiend Without a Face. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, right, yeah.
With the invisible brains, with the antenna that fly around. And, I, you know, if you think about the plot of that movie, which I do very frequently, you do see similarities between the story and that. So it's possible that this could have informed that film.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing in that reading, or in that section, that's really interesting to me is the verb play. That this alien intelligence was playing with the brains.
Yeah.
If you're not playing with toys, if it's not an innocent thing, if you apply that to almost anything else, it instantly becomes sinister.
Oh, yeah.
You're playing with people's lives. But if you know, especially if it's something like playing with somebody's brain, there's something about that really rings awful.
Well, they're taking a glee in something that is horrible.
And it's childlike. It's a great notion because, yes, we usually envision the alien invaders by virtue of getting to this planet as being intelligent creatures. But there's also this idea that, A, we don't understand what they're doing at all, or B, that they're just like, do-do-do-do-do-do, goofing around with these things. Right. It's really meaningless to them.
Yeah,
they're playing with all of our bodies as if they're playing with food. And that kind of lines up with the whole Mountains of Madness idea that humans were created as a joke. They were created out of play. The elder things were goofing off with some Play-Doh, and then it wound up being primates, you know?
Yeah.
And the whole thing really ties into the basic concept that it's just a big joke, you know? So I just thought that was really a cool segment of the story.
Frank asked Howard, he goes, well, why didn't they conquer Earth? Well, they could have totally destroyed us if they're from this other dimension. Mm-hmm. And Howard looks wistfully out the window and says, I don't know. Perhaps they discovered human brains were too trivial or absurd to bother with. Perhaps we ceased to amuse them. Perhaps they grew tired of us. But it is conceivable that the sign destroyed them or sent them back through space.
He says, I think they're gone. They haven't been around for 3 weeks. I don't know why, you know, arbitrarily, because they've been gone 3 weeks, that would mean they're gone. But that's what they're relying on.
I guess they felt safe. They feel like the creature's gone, or that the danger's away. Frank, he's getting a little bit angry, though, at Howard for trying to write this story down. He thinks it's a horrible idea. And also, how do they know it really happened? Maybe their memory's distorted, or, you know, they misremembered things, or they've blown things out of proportion. And Howard shows the scars where Henry had bit him and says, do these look like they're make-believe to you?
That means that the guy really did bite him.
Yeah.
I think that Frank is on to the right thing, though, because imagining these creatures, as we've discussed, it's the worst thing you can do. And by writing the story, Howard is in a way calling to them. I mean, he's even aware of this. He's saying, we're lucky we didn't see the hand. It's trying to show itself to us. And once we actually see it, then we're doomed. But here he is trying to get it down on paper. It's that notion that writing about things or imagining them can actually make them manifest in the world, which, you know, if you think about that cargo cult thing that I was talking about right at the beginning of the episode, you know, by Lovecraft writing these things, it caused merchandise to happen, and then the merchandise lands somewhere, and then it becomes a cult. Like, it's sure. A way that when we put things out there, that they can actually become real. And those are interesting ideas that underpin this story, despite its jokiness.
Now, there's a lot of cool stuff in the story. Yeah. It reads very effortlessly.
But as you said, Howard, his whole goal in life has been to articulate this stuff in a story. And being that he is such a dramatic, mad artist, I think that he's not thinking of himself first. He's thinking of the art first.
Frank persists and says, look, you shouldn't write this story. Is there anything I can do to change your mind about this? And Howard is adamant about it. No.
To a mad scientist extent.
Yeah, he says, I will write a story that will penetrate to the innermost core of a horror that is without form and substance, but more terrible than a plague-stricken city where the cadences of tolling bell sound to an end of all hope. I shall surpass Poe. I shall surpass all the masters.
There you go.
Total mad scientist, crazy stuff. And Frank goes, man, this is going to destroy you. You will be damned by doing this, and your ego is going to get you killed, or worse. And with that, Frank leaves. 3 days later, Frank's back at Howard's place, and he gives Frank the manuscript, and Howard is jubilant about this. He's just so excited that he's done it and he's captured the story. Mm-hmm. He feels he has. He gives it to Frank to read. Frank sits and reads it, and as he finishes the story, Howard snatches it from his hand because it's like he knew that Frank was about ready to just rip it to shreds.
Totally. And then he just says, what do you think of it?
And then he goes, it's indescribably foul. It violates privacies of the mind that should never be laid bare. Which I believe were some of the same lines used to review Mariah Carey's Glitter.
That's a direct quote.
I think so.
This manuscript becomes like The King in Yellow.
Yeah.
It's that he's reached that height of writing that no portions of it are actually included in this story, because if you or I read it, we'd go crazy too.
Right.
But even the amount that we have read, the fact that we've heard the account about the long white hand, it's putting those images in our heads. So you again have that kind of idea where, you know, just like at the end of the Call of Cthulhu story, now that you've read it, you're in trouble with the cult too.
Yeah.
I think by reading this story and reading the descriptions, now we are possibly prey to these otherworldly forces as well, which is another kind of cool level this is operating on.
So Howard asks if it's convincing, and Frank's like, yes, it's convincing. Look, I can't, it's so convincing, I can't talk to you about this right now. I've got to leave. And he does
leave, and clearly Howard has spent all of his writing talent, because as he's leaving, he goes, it is a very great story. All of his adjectives are gone. That's all I can come up with.
And now the final chapter, chapter 3. Mm-hmm. Frank is at home reading a book. It's past midnight. He gets a phone call. It's Howard. Howard says, come as quick as you can. They've come back. And Frank, the sign is powerless. I've tried the sign, but the droning gets louder and louder. Frank says, look, just keep making the sign and I'm on my way. And he goes, Frank, I've lost the power to do the sign. I forfeited all right to the protection of the sign. I've become a priest of the devil. That story, I should not have written that story.
Mm. And that line that he's become a priest of the devil, I think is a way to say, because I wrote the story, I broadcasted, I'm spreading the word, but now that I've done that, they're coming for me.
Or like the infection, like the metaphor used before is like,
yeah.
It's now he's patient zero and he's going to be spreading it out through the story.
Exactly.
So Frank runs out, hails a cab, and he's on his way. He's a little snippy with the cab driver.
Right, and asks him if it's cold night tonight, and he's like, "Fuck off, get me as quickly as possible."
So Frank is thinking about how he can't believe they would come for just one man in the middle of like such a large city. Plus, humans, why do they care about humans? Like, right? We're just these insignificant things. Why are they even bothering? You know, maybe trying to talk himself out of it. Maybe thinking that Howard's lost his mind.
Yeah. How could they possibly have come back and found us?
The line, he gives the cab driver some money and the cab driver's like, this is too much money. He goes, just keep it. Just keep it. Craziest drunk I've ever seen. He gives me $4 to drive him 10 blocks and doesn't want no thanks or nothing.
If that's the craziest drunk this cab driver has ever seen, it is clearly his first day.
Yeah, I've got plenty of stories that are about way crazier drunks than that.
Yeah, exactly. Not even being a cab driver.
So he gets to the foot of the stairs and he yells up, but there's no answer. So he warns, hey, I'm just coming up. And as he comes up, he hears Howard screaming.
Yeah, crawling, crawling. Oh, have pity. Cold and clear, crawling. God in heaven. He's getting that ice cream headache.
He gets to the top of the stairs and Howard begins screaming. This freaks Frank out so much that he cowers in the hall and starts making the sign to protect himself. Now, the door to Howard's room is slightly ajar and Frank slowly swings it open. And he sees Howard's motionless form lying on the floor with his hand kind of raised over his face with his palm out. He gets up and walks into the room, but he's only looking at Howard and he thinks, I can't look anywhere else in the room. I just have to focus on Howard, because he thinks if he looks up, something might destroy him, yet he feels compelled to look up.
Slowly, painfully, he raises his eyes.
From the ceiling to the floor it towered, and it threw off blinding light, and pierced by the shafts, whirling round and around, were the pages of Howard's story. In the center of the room, between the ceiling and the floor, the pages whirled about, and the light burned through the sheets, and descending in spiraling shafts, entered the brain of my poor friend. Into his head the light was pouring in a continuous stream, and above, the master of the light moved with a slow swaying of its entire bulk. I screamed and covered my eyes with my hands, but still the master moved back and forth, and still the light poured into the brain of my friend. And then there came from the mouth of the master a most awful sound. I had forgotten the sign that I had made 3 times below in the darkness. I had forgotten the high and terrible mystery before which all the invaders were powerless. But when I saw it forming itself in the room, forming itself immaculately, with a terrible integrity above the downstreaming light, I knew that I was saved. I sobbed and fell upon my knees. The light dwindled and the master shriveled before my eyes. And then from the walls, from the ceiling, from the floor, there leapt flame, a white and cleansing flame that consumed, that devoured and destroyed forever. But my friend was dead.
That's the end of the story.
That's the end, a cleansing fire.
Yeah, but the master?
Right.
Yeah, that's pretty strange. He gives it because the master of light, I think is what he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
Strange. So there's some intelligence there.
Yes.
It's not just a force. But a very creepy story, if not just plain strange because of the whole character choices.
Everything in it is strange. So wait, did the cross just form itself in the air magically? And that's what protected him here?
I think so.
He says, when I saw it forming itself in the room, I knew that I was saved. And right before that, it was from the mouth of the master came a most awful sound, like, oh no, a cross.
So he was saved by some other force?
Yeah, it's strange. Some
force of good, maybe? I don't know. Or maybe it was within himself and he was able to project it out in some kind of magical way. I don't know, dude. Very strange.
Altogether an odd one.
And very enjoyable. I really like Frank's stuff. I want to read more of it. And that brings us to our show next week that we're going to cover, called The Man from Time, which is a later story.
Yeah, that one's from the 50s.
Yeah, this is probably one of the more modern stories that we've ever covered on the show.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't know if we've ever cracked the 50s, actually. I mean, no. There's not a lot of Long's work out there for us to find for free, and this was one that we found online, and we're both very keen on science fiction and have been talking about lately about doing more of that in the future.
Right, yeah, we have.
We thought, heck, let's just jump ahead a couple of decades and see how Long was doing a while after he got out of the mythos phase of Lovecraft's
work. Very curious to see what his work progresses into, and we're going to check it out next week. We're going to explore that.
Master of Time. Should be interesting.
Now I want to thank Andrew Lehman once again for giving us some sweet, sweet sounds, pouring it gently into our ears. He is amazing.
It's great stuff. Please go over to the HPLHS website and pick up some gear to repay him for all the work he does for you folks.
Yeah, give it to him. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Give it to me!
At hppodcraft.com.
There you go. hppodcraft.com.